if evolution is real, and if there is this constant, I don't know, but it's visible. Like, you can measure it in certain animals.
You can measure adaptation.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence that evolution... In fact, I think we've kind of given up on the idea of evolution. The theory of evolution as articulated by Darwin is, like, kind of not true.
Right? In what sense?
Well, in the most basic sense, the idea that, you know, all life emerged from a single cell organism and over time, and there would be a fossil record of that, and there's not. And
there's not a fossil record of transitionary species, like species that are adapting to its environment.
There's tons of record of adaptation, and you see it in your own life. I mean, I have a lot of dogs. I see adaptation in dogs, you know, through the...
Sure.
Litter to litter. But no, there's no evidence at all that, none, zero, that, you know, people... you know, evolve seamlessly from a single cell amoeba. No, there's not. There's not. There's no chain in the fossil record of that at all. And that's why you don't actually hear people, you hear them make reference to evolution because the theory of adaptation is clearly, obviously true. But Darwin's theory's totally, that's why it's still a theory almost 200 years later, you know. We have not found that at all. And I can't even guess. I mean, I have my own theories on it, but they're not proven.
What are your theories?
God created people, you know, distinctly, and animals. I mean, I think that's like, I think what every person on Earth thought until the mid-19th century, actually.
Right. But
All right. I'm Ben Burgess. I am joined, as always, by our super producer, Jake Appett, and our very talented graphic designer, J. Andrew World, and today by Soviet historian of the Soviet Union, Alexander Herbert, who is joining us because today, as well as being Immanuel Kant's birthday, is also Vladimir Ilyich Lenin's birthday. So we are going to be talking about the big guy later in the show. The voice you just heard was Tucker Carlson on telling Joe Rogan that everybody's a creationist now, I guess.
I did not get that memo.
I know that sometimes Joe Rogan smokes weed with his guests. Do you think Tucker Carlson was like under the influence there? Or
if you heard that laugh that he did, that laugh makes at least one or two more reappearances. High-pitched cackle. So I don't know. I don't want to say I'm an expert on the behavior of. I don't know if it was weed or what, but it was.
I will actually go ahead and admit this is kind of pathetic, but I a couple years ago when I went on the show, I spent like a week agonizing about whether to get high with him if he asked me to. Like, it's like if he offered it, right? Like, it's like, do I get high with Rogan? Because on the one hand, that like sounds kind of bucket listy. On the other hand, I'm sure I do not have the tolerance for whatever he smokes. And like, I was worried I'd be like incoherent, you know, in what follows. So
that is the Jewish tradition that I follow, the neuroticism to just spend a week being like, do I do it? Do I not do it? You know,
and I do it and probably end up as a psalmist on air.
Again, we've talked about like some of these guys' broadcasting instincts, even if like, you know, like Alex Jones and Rogan, not to lump them, but like, I love that instinct where Rogan's like, eh, I'm pretty sure that it exists. But then he just drops it. He's like, what do you think? he's just like, all right, let's hear what you think, because it's going to be pretty funny.
Yeah, right. Like, his first instinct is to be like, no, that's crazy. Like, obviously, evolutionary biology is like a well-established science. And he's like, no, what am I doing? Just let him go. Just let him cook.
Let him riff. Yeah, yeah. Based on what I gave him earlier.
I remember that Tucker Carlson also did that cackling laugh when he interviewed Putin too, and I was like, this is so embarrassing as an American, you're doing that cackle. I don't remember what he was laughing at, but I think it was
when Putin would insult him. He would laugh. Yeah.
I mean, I loved the Putin interviews later where he was like the interviews he gave on Russian TV where they asked him about talking to Kotucker, and he was like, seemed like very simple man. I was surprised. I thought he would be smart. It's like, but it's funny that you mentioned the Putin interview, because we have another. Let's do the second Tucker clip here.
So they're from here, and they've been here for thousands of years, whatever they are. And it's pretty clear to me that they're spiritual entities, whatever that means. They're supernatural, and which is to say, supernatural means above the natural, above the observable nature. And they don't behave according to the laws of science as measured by people, you know. And they've been here for a long time. And there's a ton of evidence that are under the ocean and under the ground. So, like, with that fact set, what do you conclude?
Yeah. And I have to say, when I was watching this, the Tucker saying there's tons of evidence. So not enough evidence for Darwinian evolution, tons of evidence that there are aliens in the ocean. And
yeah.
But they're not actually aliens. They're spiritual beings. I flashed to a moment in the Tucker Putin interview where he, you know, where you remember he asked Putin at one point, I think kind of assuming there might be a little bit more cross-cultural conservative commonality here, that, you know, he's like, do you ever feel when you think about these events that there's the, you know, like the, you know, that there's something more than human going on here, that there's some sort of spiritual dimension, or, you know, hand of God. And like, then they do the translation, and then, you know, Putin says something in Russian, translate, no, I don't think that. Like, it just like completely refused to like humor, you know, like whatever, you know, like whatever Tucker was saying. It's like, no, that sounds stupid, man.
It sounds like Tucker was like watching The Abyss and was like taking edibles at the time. But like, you know how you're supposed to like just take one and just like give it a moment, let it get into your system. He's just like, man, I'm not feeling the effects. And just keeps taking more and more edibles. And then like, this is the result of after watching.
And then he was like, oh shit, I'm supposed to be on Rogan in like 15 yeah. minutes.
So. Yeah, I got to turn off The Abyss.
Yeah, I mean, Ben, I picked up on that same contradiction, right? That on the one hand, you know, evolution is just a theory, and theories are not, they're not law. But for some reason, these supernatural beings at the bottom of the ocean are like the laws of science. They defy the laws of science. It's like, okay, well, what is the law of science to you, Tucker Carlson? Is it creationism? I don't really get it, but... I think he's probably smoked weed with Joe Rogan before.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems fair. Yeah, I was only offered bourbons, so that was fine. But yeah, this is all the worrying was pointless. But anyway, so I think we've established that this was a pretty amazing interview. We got the creationism. We have the aliens that aren't actually aliens. They're actually supernatural beings, you know, living under the ocean. We also had this.
Well, you could say the same about the atomic bomb, right?
Yes, you could.
And you could say that we have to develop it like Oppenheimer felt before the Nazis did.
I love that. How'd that work? How'd that work?
Well,
I love, by the way, that people on my side, I'll just admit it, on the right, you know, have spent the last 80 years defending dropping nuclear weapons on civilians. Like, are you joking?
Right.
That's just like prima facie evil. Yeah. If you can't, well, if we hadn't done that, then this, that, the other thing, that was actually a great savings life. No, it's wrong to drop nuclear weapons on people. And if you find yourself arguing that it's a good thing to drop nuclear weapons on people, then you are evil. Like it's not a tough one, right? It's not a hard call for you. It's not a hard call for me. So with that in mind, like, why would you want nuclear weapons? It's like just a mindless, childish sort of intellectual exercise to justify, like, oh no, it's really good because someone else will get it. How about no? How about?
And out of those three clips, say, all right, the various opinions he's expressing here, that third one was the one that got the attention of the Daily Wire's Jeremy Boring, who I think we have the tweet from him. People who deny the moon landing or suggest America is evil for its use of atomic weapons against Imperial Japan, or who say that George Bush was behind 9/11, actually hate this country. You know, one of these things is not like the other two. This is like one of those SAT questions, you know, you're supposed to differentiate, you know, like, you know, which item doesn't fit. So, yeah, this is like, all right, man, we can all, you know, like the alien beings under the ocean that are actually supernatural, you know, creationism, whatever. Fine, fine, fine. Wait, you think dropping atomic weapons on civilians was bad? God, sounds like you hate America.
Yeah, or he saw the abyss, which is the whole point of that movie.
Okay, all right. I really love that it's like all the insanity in that interview. We're gonna watch a bunch of it in the post game, but all of the insanity that was going on in that interview, like the one moment of like actual moral lucidity that he has is the one that's like an issue for Jeremy Boring. It's like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, maybe it was really bad to like massacre a bunch of, you know, random like children and housewives and, you know, like doctors and nurses in Hiroshima.
Yeah, I mean, I think compared to the moon landing one, which is, you know, it's not one I believe in, but I think that's comparatively pretty mild. You know, that's always the conspiracy theory that when I found myself arguing with someone, I'd be like, just let them believe it. You know, like it's not the worst versus, you know, I mean, also, you know, there's two conspiracy to your point about the SAT analogy section or whatever, which I think is actually defunct. But this would have been a good question, you know, 20 years ago or so. But it was also two of them are conspiracy theories, and one is like a moral judgment. It doesn't really. I understand that he's trying to equate them, but it's just
But morally, should we have gone to the moon?
Yeah, people who believe we should have gone to the moon or that Bush shouldn't have done 9/11. Yeah. But no, it to Tucker's point, which I don't say very often, if you find yourself like Jeremy Boring, just passionately defending, you know, that's the one thing you're passionately defending from refuting from a 3-hour interview, you know, no matter what you think about it, like, you know, just the right to kill hundreds of thousands of people without even questioning it, you know, it's probably good to think about whatever political side you're on, to think about like, am I doing the best I could be doing? But, you know, I mean, like, should I, like, I think that's a good time to like at least give it, at least back up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've got to say, I don't say the sentence very often, but I think Tucker Carlson is completely correct that, you know, I think that like wiping out a city full of random people who don't get to decide Japanese foreign policy is in fact prima facie evil, right? Like that's, and you know, and it is in fact, really vile to defend that. And it's funny. I've actually seen, so the Jeremy Boring one was the first one we saw, so that's why we included the tweet, but I've seen several of these since then, you know, of like sort of, you know, conservatives being like, whoa, he was really out of line, you know, with that Hiroshima thing. You know, it's like, this is, I really can't imagine being not only defending that, but being so emotionally invested in defending it that you're offended by somebody saying that it was wrong.
I think that there are like the people who defend it, let's be honest, I think that they're sort of fringe, right? It's a minority of people that still like vehemently defend it. But there are people who still wrestle with this supposed moral dilemma, right, that the American president had to go through. And, you know, I think America today has sort of the consensus is that it was wrong to do. And so from that perspective, when you view movies like Oppenheimer, right, the new American narrative has been to let's glorify the inventor of the bomb as this sort of person who invented this bad thing against his will, right? He didn't want it to be used. This is the narrative. He didn't want it to be used for this atrocious purpose. So therefore we can glorify Oppenheimer while also condemning the use of the bomb. But it's like, you know, the two things are sort of the same here, because there's a whole lot of defense contractors that were invested in Oppenheimer, like developing this bomb. So,
yeah, right. I mean, that's a weird, I mean, there is definitely a delicate line there, because definitely a lot of the movie's case for him is that he felt bad about it. Right. Yeah. You know, but, you know, I don't know. it's not like the sort of basic purpose of this, you know, is like, it's not like you thought you were building a, I mean, I see your point. It's not like you thought he was building a, you know, civilian nuclear reactor to, you know, provide electricity until the last second. It was like, oh, wait, what? Right. Like, I mean, this was definitely the idea all along. So it's like, yeah, it does, you know, if you think he was right to feel bad about it, then, you know, then you should definitely question some of his earlier decisions.
I think also you're talking about like the way they're vehemently defending this, assume, you know, some of them are whatever, just sociopaths defending some kind of line. But I also think it does remind me of Zionists who, now that like the dam has broken on this like consensus, right? Similarly, like, you know, I remember when I was young, the consensus that obviously dropping those sure. bombs was the right thing to do was pretty intact, you know, much more intact than it is now. Because then, you know, once you kind of unseal that, whatever you want to call it, then it's, you're really facing a horrible reality, right? Which is the same thing the Zionists would have to. If they're not right, then how fucking wrong they are. You know what I mean? Because if you're not, in order to be right, like, you're like, yeah, we had to, you know, we had to keep these people in an open air prison, and we have to kill a bunch of them a lot, you know, and like with right. this war going on, we have to kill thousands of them. If you even let in any countervailing evidence that like what we're doing isn't like not just like a little bit right, it's actually like holy and great, then like the true monstrousness of what you're doing is coming out. You know what I mean? So it's like, I think from a moral perspective, if you start letting in any of those moral questions, like any of those like little questions in your head, like maybe we shouldn't have done that, then like, you know, a whole edifice is going to crumble. At least, I mean, it really does remind me of how, which we were talking a little bit too before we went on air about just like some of the, like, you know, some Zionists, like now that there's a new consensus, like they're just kind of, I don't want to say going crazy, but they're just acting. A lot of people are acting. Well, really, some of them really are strange.
going pretty crazy, right? I mean, there's the Professor Shai at Columbia. I have seen the guy. Like that really seems like a slow motion mental breakdown in front of global news cameras.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we do have a little bit, I guess, the tweet.
Oh, okay, sure, sure, shy. Sure.
I have not just a civil right as a Jewish person to be on campus. I have a right as a professor employed by the university to be on campus. They deactivated my card. These are 5 lawsuits in happening. But we don't want to do it. We just want to be Jewish and
Yeah, so this is for context. This dude has been spending the last, I don't know, bunch of days you know, tearing around campus, I think causing like 5 lawsuits per visit, and you know, hysterically accusing his students of being terrorists. There's a tweet where he says terrorism is an ideology and they believe that ideology, therefore they're terrorists, which is, you know, confusing on many levels, right? You'd think terror, you know, various terrorists historically have had many ideologies. You know, people have been sympathetic to them without actually being terrorists. But, you know, he's like basically going around screaming at people and getting confrontations and trying to stir stuff up. And eventually, to de-escalate a little bit, the Columbia administration seems to have like deactivated his key card for the day to force him to take a day off. That might be I don't know what the long-term plan is, right? But like, that's all I got out of the tweets I saw today. And it's really funny too, because like what really struck me about this is that he was, there's a different video clip that where we don't have, but I saw it today where he's like striding to the gates of Columbia University with this Israeli flag like draped around his back, like it's his Captain Israel cape. And then like he gets up there and he tries to get in, his key card's been deactivated and he flips out, and you know, we saw the rest. But like what really gets me about this is just like the put, you know, put it aside, you know, whatever you think about, you know, Shai's relations to his employer right now, and, you know, how where all that might go. Like, it's like, okay, so this guy's narrative is that Columbia University is like a hotbed of violent anti-Semitism, and there's like, you know, it's been taken over by like violent, you know, pro Hamas mobs. That's what he keeps saying. And like, if he, you know, we need to call the National Guard right now because it's such a, you know, horrible danger to everybody's safety to have these pro Hamas mobs run around. It's like, I don't know, man. If you actually thought there were like violent anti-Semitic pro Hamas mobs around, you probably would not come striding into campus with the Captain Israel look, right? Like that seems like maybe not what you would do if you really believe that.
Good point.
Or he's just incredibly, incredibly brave. You know, whether your key card is deactivated for the day is like, you know, probably the biggest issue that us as a Jewish people has faced, you know, whether your key card to the prestigious university where you teach like intro to business or whatever he teaches, I think it was also, well, I think it was only so he couldn't enter one part also, I think. I don't think it was the entire, I don't know if he was actually barred from
campus entirely that day.
I'm not sure. I think it was just because, yeah, like you said, he was going to try, like, I don't know. I just think that, like, if you think, I don't know. Like,
this doesn't seem, you know, yeah, I mean, we were kind of joking around before we started recording. I was thinking about the, you know, struggles faced by, you know, like my great grandfather and, you know, the Pale of Settlement when they probably, you know, probably some days he had his key card act deactivated. You know,
just that's where they're going next. That's like Howard Schultz giving that like weird Holocaust speech. Remember,
first they came for the key cards.
Yeah.
This is, yeah, doubtless why he had to flee. But yeah. Okay. So, on that subject, let's actually maybe to go with, since we've been talking about it anyway, let's maybe switch around the order a little bit. We'll start with the first clip from the Palestine part of it. I went on Frank Morano, The Other Side of Midnight on WABC, which I have done before. It's been a long time. And this is actually way better. I don't really know. I have a good grip on like who the listener base is, because it's you know, New York City talk radio. But on the other hand, it's you know, the show is from like 1 to 3 in the morning New York time. But at least now that I'm on the West Coast, that's a much gentler time frame, you know, to be a guest on the show than it used to be. But yeah, let's maybe skip to the part where he starts asking me about the Palestine stuff.
All right. I want to go through a few items that have been in the news, sort of. Sure. We'll get to as many as we can here. You have written a great deal about the war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas. I like a lot of progressives, my impression in your writing is that you think Israel is not behaving appropriately, and it's also inappropriate for the United States to be aiding Israel. Do I have your position down accurately?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think that this is, you know, I think that the carnage going on in Gaza right now has reached some pretty unspeakable levels. You have 1.9 million out of 2.3 million civilians who live in Gaza who've been displaced from their homes. There's really been a systematic destruction of Palestinian, you know, like the sort of conditions for normal Palestinian society going back to what it was in Gaza before this started. And I would also say that if you look at the history of our country's wars in the Middle East after 9/11, the idea that the effect of this is just going to be that there's no more Hamas, or, you know, no equivalent of Hamas, that, you know, that there won't be more terrorism, doesn't seem very likely to me. I mean, you know, we spent 20 years in Afghanistan destroying the Taliban, and I think we saw how that went. I see very little reason to think that this is going to play out in a better way, especially because I think most human beings, if they see their brothers and sisters, parents, you know, cousins killed, you know, are not going to respond in the way that, you know, that would be hoped for by the military that's doing this stuff. I think that this is the kind of thing that would lead a lot of people to go out and join terrorist organizations in much the same way that, you know, many Israelis understandably, you know, might have wanted to join the IDF to get some kind of vengeance after October 7th.
Sure. Sure. That makes sense to me. And I don't want to focus too much on the policy here because I have a longstanding rule of not debating people that are significantly smarter than me. And unfortunately, you fall into that category. And I do want to ask you about the politics, but just on the policy, you have a lot of people listening to this. And there's two questions, even folks that haven't necessarily followed every step of this war. And there's two questions that really stick out. One is, if there's a ceasefire or an end to Israeli hostilities, how does Israel get all of their hostages back? That's question one. And two, if there's a ceasefire, how can Israel and the United States, by extension, be assured that Hamas won't just regroup and try something similar like this in the future?
Sure. So I would say on the first question that the best shot for getting all the hostages back safely would be as part of the negotiations for a permanent ceasefire. That, you know, in fact, there are at least a few cases of Israeli hostages who were who have been killed by the IDF that we're sure of, because if you're engaged in this indiscriminate a siege, you know, that's bound to happen. And I would be very unsurprised if it later turned out to be other cases that we don't know about. And in fact, if you are going in, guns blazing, I think that is the kind of thing that, you know, really endangers the lives of hostages, which is why, in fact, even as Israeli politics has become, you know, I mean, the, don't get me wrong, I'm very aware that the vast majority of that country supports the war, but really some of the only voices of opposition have come from families of hostages for exactly that reason. And I think that if you had like a real long-term ceasefire, not a 6-week pause and then we're going to go right back to doing what we're doing, and oh, by the way, those million people aren't allowed to return to northern Gaza while it's happening, but like a real permanent ceasefire, I think that's the best chance of saving those people's lives. And as far as the idea of something like this happening again, I would just question the idea that you're going to prevent something like this from ever happening again by, again, displacing millions of Palestinians, killing tens of thousands of Palestinian children, et cetera. I think all of that stuff could actually supercharge future recruitment to Hamas or some successful organization in the future. I think as far as ending the cycle of violence, because you're right, if you don't change anything, there's every chance that, you know, that there will be future outbreaks of violence, of course. But I think as far as ending this to the cycle of violence in the long term, I think the only way that could ever happen is if there's some kind of permanent settlement so it's no longer the case that you have all of these millions of Palestinians who are living as stateless non-citizen subjects of Israel. I think that's the only way you could calm that down in the long term.
Yeah, it was a little bit hard for me to tell, actually, what his own view on this is. I think he might not have actually completely disagreed with all this. Like, it might have just, you know, a lot of this might have just been kind of like, here are the questions his audience expects him to ask. And, you know, so he's just going to kind of run through them. But this is my best attempt at sort of like, what's my like relatively normie friendly attempt to sort of say, here's why, you know, even on their own terms, right, none of the justifications for this, you know, make any sense, and, you know, and it really needs to stop.
Yeah, I think, I think that's a good rhetorical strategy to get people in the middle. And I also have to say, I kind of like his, he says, you're smarter than me. I'm going to listen. I guess if there was a smart Zionist, he would just sit back and listen. But, he also kind of has that, like, kind of an old fashioned radio voice. You know what I mean? Like it was nice to listen to in an age of just like Twitch streaming and stuff like that.
Well, we do have a little bit more on this part.
So Ben, I mean, a lot of, and we're talking with Ben Burgess, you could check out his columns and his book and find him on Twitter. A lot of interesting things all around. Ben, how can Israel live peacefully with the Palestinians in the future, especially with Hamas in control of the Gaza Strip, when Hamas has indicated that they view October 7th as the beginning of many more such attacks? And the charter of Hamas is obviously, you know, deeply anti-Israel and mm-hmm. anti-Semitic. How do you live side by side with that situation?
Yeah, so I would say, two things. One is as far as Hamas goes, even Hamas has said, I think back in 2017, if I've got that right, that despite what the original charter says, that they would be willing to, for the sake of national unity, accept a two-state settlement, even though they don't think they should have to. And so, if people are going to bring up the original charter, I think they should also talk about that. But I think more importantly, the question is, well, look, Hamas is awful. You're certainly not going to get an argument from me about that, right? I have no...
Sure.
For many obvious reasons, right? Hamas is awful. But the question is, how is it that there are this many people who are willing to sign up for an organization like Hamas, that they have been willing to exert this level of power for so long? And I think that's inseparable from the Israeli occupation, from the human rights abuses that happen. I mean, that's why you get this pool of people who have become willing to support that. And I think the only way to undercut that in the long term is to change the conditions that give rise to it. And one last point about this, I would also say that, we're used to, when you ask questions like that, we're used to thinking about it in those terms, because we're used to thinking about, seeing ourselves in the Israelis for all sorts of cultural and historical reasons. But I would point out that you could ask all the same questions with at least equal force in the other direction. So on October 7th, there were 1,200 Israelis who were killed. I think the current Israeli estimate is about 695 of them were civilians, which is awful. But in the 6 months since then, you have had 33,000 Palestinians killed, the overwhelming majority [S2] Right. [S1] Of whom are women and children. And you could equally say the ruling party of Israel could says in its equivalent of an original charter, right? Its original charter as a party that they think that Israel should permanently control everything from the river to the sea. And so if you combine that with what they've actually been doing in the last 6 months, you could equally ask, well, how could the Palestinians be expected to peacefully live side [S2] Sure. [S1] By side with people who've done that to them?
Ben,
and ultimately, I hope people can live side by side, because the only other option is this forever.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's always a little bit of other people's experience may differ. I always feel like I'm a little bit unsure about how much to how to sort of balance like making the basic point that I want to with like, all right, what's the, it's like you're not going to get people on everything in one conversation. So it's like, what's the, I'm not going to sort of do my, you should have a single state, solution with right of return and all that stuff. And that, that context, cause like, that feels like that's going to be about another hour of conversation, but like, at least they say, look, you got to do something, right? Like, or else, like whatever, you know, whatever is politically or practically possible at any point in the future, whatever. It's like, look, if you like oppress people in this violent and brutal way for this long, right? I mean, this is you're going to get like, you know, the idea that there's like such a thing as like a, you know, it's like a peaceful occupation that, you know, that you're just going to like, you know, kill so many people that they'll just agree that, you know, you can just, you know, that you can just occupy them forever. And, you know, and they'll stop shooting in that direction just seems, you know, completely delusional to me. And I think that even if you don't accept any sort of like larger critique I might have of Zionism, it just seems like that much feels like it should be common sense.
It's not that far off from Martin Luther King's speech from, I believe, Stanford, if I remember correctly. But he was discussing riots, and he basically said that, you know, you shouldn't be angry at the riot itself. You don't have to agree with the actions, but you should be angry at the conditions that caused people to feel that that was the justifiable actions to do. And
I
try to approach it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think like King's point was like, obviously he didn't agree with the riots, but he, you know, he thought that like, you know, the riots were sort of a second order issue, right? That they have the sort of first order issue is the conditions that give rise to it. Right. And I think that like, it's not a question of, you know, obviously as a, you know, secular socialist, atheist, part Jewish, etc. Right. For many reasons, right. Hamas is not, you know, let's put it this way. They would not have my vote if I got to vote in Palestinian elections, but, the
PLO to the polls.
It's a deep cut.
I stole that from Forrest, by the way.
I would, you know, I don't know. I have I guess out of the options available, I'd seriously consider casting my vote for the, you know, the sort of as sort of weird and Stalinist as they are for, you know, the PFLP. That seems like maybe the best option on there. But
I wrote in Dick Cheney when I voted in that election.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, the, you know, they're for many, many obvious reasons, right? Not my, you know, not my favorite people, but like, you know, the question is just like, yeah, why should you think that if you could do, you know, if you continue the conditions that have given rise to this, in fact, you make those conditions much, much worse, right? That like Hamas is just going to like magically cease to exist. That doesn't make any sense. All right. Got some other stuff, but I think we're going to save it for the post game. Right now we are going to move from the Middle East in 2024 to Eastern Europe in the early decades of the 20th century. So right now, this actually worked out extremely well because we've been talking about you coming on to talk about this very good article that you wrote for your Substack. I think we have it's called Do We Really Need Lenin Today on Personality Cults and Idolizing the Past. And then it turned out that, you know, this Monday today is actually Lenin's birthday. So, you know, maybe no better time for a discussion of the man. And also a discussion of sort of the ways that people relate to him and his legacy now that might not be useful. But Alex, I mean, what do you get us started with just like, you know, since you're a new character in the GTA extended universe, people might not be too familiar with who you are and what you do, although some people may have seen you, of course, on our socialist sibling podcast, This Is Revolution. Do you want to just kind of start out by saying a little bit about who you are and what you do, both academically and then, you know, Lenin in 45 volumes and all of that?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, first of all. I'm a fan of your takes frequently. You have good takes. So as you mentioned, I do this project called Lenin in 45 volumes, right? And in the English version of Lenin's works, there are 45 volumes in total. Two of those are index volumes alone. And so I'm going volume by volume and posting 5 to 7 minute videos that sort of summarize the contents of each volume. And the purpose of that is not to idolize Lenin. Yeah. The purpose of that is to show that he's a very specific historical figure, right? He exists in specific time and his ideas change over time. So, you know, the book starts in the 1880s and it's going to go until his death. That's one project that I do. I also do, as you mentioned, the Substack, where I, you know, post my opinions and articles about various topics. I have one on that I called The Problem of American Communism, where I start talking about the Comintern in the 1920s and how they were extremely frustrated with American communists because they were bickering with each other all the time and they couldn't come together. And, you know, I reflect on that today, right? It's still a reality today that American socialists and communists just like to bicker with each other. And various other topics. There's another one called Weird Marxism, which I try to kind of square the occult and astrology with Marxism, right? Try to carve out a place for it, maybe in conversation with Adorno and some other people. That a lot of people have enjoyed. That was based on a reading group that I led. That was a very fruitful reading group, and you know, a lot of opinions were there. But I am a historian of the Soviet Union, in particular of what they call an environmental historian. So I look at the relationship between the Soviet Union and its environment, how it influenced its environment, and how the environment influenced itself. With a particular affinity for Lenin or interest in Lenin, not as a sort of, as the article pointed out, not in a sort of idolizing way, but as a historical figure. You know, he is without doubt my favorite revolutionary character of revolutionary history. But again, I think that it's important to fix him in his historical moment. And I think that a lot of people on the left nowadays don't really do that, right? They're sort of pulling quotes from Lenin and trying to apply them to the United States in 2024. And it leads to a lot of misunderstanding about him and a lot of misreading of Lenin himself.
Let's talk about that, you know, historical moment, you know, going back to, you know, to the 1880s, you know, because it seems like, you know, like Lenin is somebody who's constantly engaged in, like, you know, polemical battles with other Russian revolutionaries who he disagrees with, that are often sort of incomprehensible outside of this, like, really specific historical context. Like, you give an example in your Substack about seeing somebody on Twitter, like, referencing something that Lenin had written, advocated abstention in elections to the Tsarist Duma, and, like, sort of concluding that that means that, like, communists should never participate in, you know, bourgeois elections, which is, which is, like, fun on multiple levels, because it's like, okay, I mean, even Lenin himself took the opposite position in other contexts and did actually advocate participation in some election, you know, some elections in capitalist countries. But also, just, you know, beyond that, right, that just the sort of, you know, there's something that's, like, really weird about the idea that you could just kind of copy and paste, like, you know, let's assume for the sake of argument that, like, Lenin is infallible, it gets everything right, right? Like, even if that was true, right, there's something really odd about the idea that you can just sort of copy and paste, like, a strategic perspective about, like, Russia in the 1880s or 1890s or 1900s or 1910s and paste it into the context of a technologically advanced capitalist democracy that has, like, you know, tons of internal legitimacy and, you know, all that stuff. So, I mean, I mean, one way of like kind of starting to approach this is like, yeah, so you said like the starts in the 1880s, right? So it's like when you think about the Russian Empire in the 1880s, I mean, what kind of country are we talking about at that point?
Well, most importantly, we're talking about an autocracy, right? Which is different than anything else in Europe, even different than the Austrian monarchy at the time, more centralized. The autocracy exercises what's called prizvol, which means arbitrariness. It's arbitrary rule of the autocrat. And Lenin is born April 22nd, today, 1970. And that's only 9 years after the serfs are emancipated by Alexander VI, right? So Lenin is, you know, not very old, of course. I mean, he's not born yet, but his parents are of age. And his father's family comes from a serf background. So there is some knowledge there, some experience, a little bit of experience there. Another you know, important development in Russia at the time of Lenin's birth, 1872 is the first, when the first translation of Capital, Das Kapital, is published in Russia, right? And so he's growing up in this very specific time. And in terms of revolutionary praxis, it is the moment of the Narodniki, or the sort of populist movement in Russia, right? These are people that believed that you could have a popular revolution led by the peasants that would form itself around the peasant communes, right? It would look like a elongated federation of peasant communes. And that the best way to do that, to advocate for that, was one, to go to the people themselves, right? And advocate amongst the peasantry that it is within your interest to petition or go against the Tsar. And then two, the other strategy was terrorism, right? To literally blow up the Tsar's carriage as a way of sending a message to the establishment that this is the path of revolutionary action. And Lenin's brother gets caught up in that, right? Lenin's brother famously is a member of one of these terrorist organizations. He's arrested, he's executed, and most biographers of Lenin have kind of put their finger on that as that's the moment that radicalized Lenin the most. Although...
Yeah, sorry, you were saying a little...
No, go ahead.
So, you know, rewind a minute, like you... So you're talking about the Narodniki and you... And, you know, you said, so there were like two strategies. One was going to the people and sort of trying to organize, you know, because like Russia at this point is like a overwhelmingly rural, you know, peasant society, right, which, you know, really starts to change, like, you know, during Lenin's lifetime. But like even by 1917, it's still pretty overwhelmingly rural, like not as much as it was. But and then the other is revolutionary terrorism. And my understanding, I mean, you know, you should tell me, but it's like my understanding is that the second one is to a large extent a reflection of the failure of the first one, right? You know, that there's the there's this mass event, the going to the people, that's sort of very unsuccessful because you have this like extremely conservative peasant society that sort of takes all of these like sees all these like urban intellectual revolutionaries and kind of wants nothing to do with them. Right. I mean, this is like the, I think Plekhanov, you know, the founder of Russian Marxism says somewhere, you know, they, you know, like he has this joke about, you know, it's the going to the people and then the people sent them back.
Yeah. I mean, it's also unsuccessful because the Tsar frees the serfs in 1861. And so a lot of these revolutionaries, the peasants, you have to understand it from their perspective, first of all, is kind of naively looking at it as this is a good development, right? And that's extremely frustrating for revolutionaries who want to overthrow the autocracy ultimately. And so they do, they ramp up the terrorism in the last quarter of the 19th century. And Lenin will famously write in the 1890s, one of his first major pieces is about the development of capitalism in Russia. And what he says is that the emancipation of the serfs is actually the beginning of the development of capitalism in peasant Russia, because now you have sort of privatized land in a way that it hadn't been before. You've divvied it up into peasants. You've allowed these big rural landowners to buy up the small plots of the peasants. And so you're creating a rural proletariat. And that's where Lenin sort of gets his first major publication in the 1898, I believe, or 1897 is the first one. Go ahead.
So what's this first publication about?
The development of capitalism in Russia. It's precisely about that, right? It's about the beginning of the process of proletarianization within rural Russia, right? That because there's so many people there, especially the Narodniki, who are arguing that, well, Russia can't have this kind of socialist revolution that Marx is talking about because it's too agricultural, it's too rural. And Lenin is pointing out, like, look, you're right. It is primarily agricultural. It is primarily rural. But we have a sort of proletarianization of the peasants going on in the countryside, the likes of which are not similar to anywhere else, because Russia is just a big agricultural country. And that the emancipation of the serfs has done nothing except for facilitate the growth of this sort of rural bourgeoisie or rural landowners that are able to swallow up the plots that peasants realistically can't pay for, right? Because the emancipation wasn't just you're free and you own this property now. It was, you know, you can leave the commune and you have to pay for your plot. You have to pay the landlord to own this plot. And, you know, they'll never
sort of reverse reparations there.
Reverse reparations. The Russian serfs don't get any reparations.
They have to pay reparations to the people who they had formerly been had like feudal obligations towards. Not unlike Haiti, I guess, after the slave revolt there, you know, having to pay off France, you know, for the privilege of freedom. So this is like also interesting because, you know, that like you kind of alluded to like it's something that's going to be a big debate between Russian revolutionaries in this period, which is like, in fact, you know, earlier you'd mentioned Capital, you know, being translated into Russian. And, you know, my understanding is that, you know, I think like the Russian censors like let it through because it was like, oh, this seems like harmless, partially because it's like a lot of it's pretty dry economics, but also because it's like, well, if anything, this doesn't seem to be about us, right? I mean, this is about these like industrial capitalist conditions in Britain, you know, that are very different from what they have in Russia. And so you have these different positions. There's like the Narodniki position that's like, okay, you're not going to have the sort of workers' revolution that you know, that Marxists would hope for as the transition to socialism. But you know, there's this whole debate that's like, you know, I know it's like a little bit complicated, but in like broad strokes, right? Like what are the different positions that different kinds of people who do basically agree with Marx, you know, have at this point about like what could happen in Russia?
So there's in March of 1898, the first Russian Social Democratic Party is founded in Minsk, right? And this is sort of a bringing together of, at this point, there's not really any kind of like ideological divide yet. Everybody is sort of unified in what becomes called the minimum program, right? Which is the overthrow of autocracy. That's the number one goal that we can all agree that we need to win. We need to advocate for, and we need to do it in an organized way. We need a party to do it. So we're going to form this party, in what is now Belarus. And that sort of kicks off this long historical process through the first, the second, and then kind of culminating in the third party Congress. The third is where, you know, the split between Bolshevik and Menshevik kind of becomes irreparable. But the split occurs just a few years after that, I mean, within 4 years after that. And the disagreements are over what Lenin calls party organization. So on the one hand, you have Lenin and the Bolsheviks, who want to have a firmer control over the people who are allowed to join the party, right? That it, he says, it's not enough for you to pay dues and pretend to be a member of the Communist Party just by paying dues. You have to be actively participating in party organization somehow. And that's what gives you access to party membership. And then there are the minority. And at this point, they are the minority group. And they say, no, we are a mass party. We need to accept everybody that's willing to pay their dues. And, you know, we have to understand that some people can give more than others in terms of, you know, their financial support and physical support. And this is sort of the root, the major root of the split. It becomes super personal. And it becomes personal in a sense because Lenin is polemic, as you pointed out. He's I mean, this is, I think, something that a lot of American leftists try to parrot, right? Is the the polemics of Lenin, which, you know, none of all of them kind of pale in comparison to the sort of articulate polemics that that he was able to pull off. But Lenin even incurs the wrath of Plekhanov, who you mentioned, the sort of father of Russian Marxism. But at first, Plekhanov is on his side. Plekhanov says at first, yeah, I agree. We should have limits over party membership. That's a way of avoiding opportunism. It's a way of avoiding the sort of spies, I guess, in the party. And so we should control more who does what. But Lenin's polemics get so ahead of him that Plekhanov gets to the point where he says, look, what we need more than anything else in, this is 1902, 1903, Russia, is a unified party. And so if this split in the party is going to permanently split the party, then you, Lenin, or you, Martynov, have to resign your positions, right? And Lenin says, no, absolutely not. I'm not going to do that. Eventually, he does concede. He says, okay, I'll step down from the editorial board of Iskra, which is the main party organ. He steps down from it, but then he forms his own newspaper. Proletari is the name of the newspaper that he forms as the organ of what will become the Bolshevik faction of the party. That's the first root of this split, is over party organization. And it will morph now into, as the revolution of 1905 happens and a Duma is created, and there's, should make an important distinction, there's two different Dumas. There's the Duma that is formed as a consultative body. It's not a legislative body. It's a consultative body, and it's formed before October 1905. And then there's the legislative Duma, which is formed after October 1905, right? After the revolution. And Lenin says, we shouldn't participate in this consultative body because it's a waste of time. You know, it's going to be dominated by liberals, and you know, the Tsar is just going to put his own counselors in there. Who cares? But when the legislative Duma is formed after the October Manifesto, then Lenin says Russian social democracy has to have some kind of representation within this legislative body, not because we're going to achieve revolution through the legislative body, but because it's going to allow us to point out the contradictions of the entire system itself, not just the Duma, but the autocracy in its effort to constantly overstep the Duma and ignore the legislature. And so it becomes another source of splits, right? Because Mensheviks, the Menshevik faction will say, well, we can actually participate in this electoral body, this legislative body, and achieve change through it. Lenin comes to reject that and again enters into some pretty heated polemics with his opponents about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I mean, it's a little bit funny. My understanding is that, you know, that Bolshevik-Menshevik split, you know, right? So Bolshevik means majority in Russian and Menshevik means minority. And it's like, okay, as you say, there is a point at which that was accurate, and there were other points at which the Mensheviks are a majority, but it maybe says something about the man's personality that, you know, he managed to like permanently brand it as, you know, as the majority of faction, right? You know, that this, and, you know, maybe the personalities of his enemies, that they weren't quite there. So this is all happening, you know, like some of this history you're laying out, right? Like is, all happening while, you know, Russia, you know, as you say, it's an autocracy. After the 1905 revolution, is they allow the legislative Duma with some power, you know, but not that much. This is really this like kind of quasi feudal state, in, you know, not, they don't serve him anymore, although not that, like, it hasn't even been that long since they did. Right. But like, you know, but certainly on the sort of highest level is like, has this like kind of quasi feudal, state structure. And, it has, and it's starting, you know, it's starting to industrialize. Right. So there is like a working class, like a recognizable kind of working class in the cities. But I mean, this is like really islands of industrial capitalism in this kind of rural environment. And so, you know, what a lot of people expect is like, okay, so first we have to have a bourgeois democratic revolution, that's going to overthrow the autocracy. And then at, you know, some point we'll have a proletarian socialist revolution afterwards, or, you know, maybe, you know, I guess I'm not totally sure I understand Lenin's position in this period, but it seems like he kind of thinks that, like, he sort of thinks that, but he also sort of thinks that the working class can like take this like very leading role from early on, and maybe like, you know, transition between the two doesn't have to take that long.
Yeah, this is actually a really important period after, during, and then after 1905, because Lenin really starts to write a lot about what he calls the minimum and maximum program. He differentiates between the two. The minimum program for him, and this is in the framework of the democratic revolution that they're imagining, is that minimally the social democrats need to work towards overthrowing the autocracy. That's the minimum goal, right? Yeah. The liberals, of course, are going to try to get a constitutional monarch. But for Lenin, you know, that doesn't matter. The idea is, let's overthrow Przyvol. Let's get rid of autocratic arbitrariness, autocratic arbitrary power, minimally. And that requires the social democrats to take part in the democratic revolution. But he's really careful of saying here that we have to take part in the democratic revolution, but we have to give no ground to our enemies, right? We'll work with them when it's strategically, politically necessary, but we'll give no ground to them. We will constantly be pushing them, pointing out the contradictions in their own position. And the max versus the maximum program, right? The maximum program is the socialist revolution, the overthrow of the democratic, what will become the provisional government, right? And then the triumph of the working class. But throughout this entire process, you can't lose sight of the fact that it is the working class that is at the forefront of this project. And that focus on the minimum and maximum program becomes sort of the main argumentative line for Lenin through this process, which, as you pointed out, you know, from 1905, from the October Manifesto to the beginning of the First World War, Lenin is really, really concerned with and writing about the influx of Western capital into Russia, right? And the ways in which Western capital are sort of invested in Russia's success, in the Tsar's success, really. And he has this one article called The Fall of Port Arthur, right? This is during the Russo-Japanese War, which a lot of people don't really write about. And what he points out is that France and Britain had heavy investments in railroad infrastructure in Port Arthur. They had heavy investments in export trade or import trade in Port Arthur. The French and the British are invested in Port Arthur becoming a hub, a pro-Western hub for Western imperialism in East Asia. They want it to be a place where they can sort of, you know, use as a base of their own projects in China and Southeast Asia. And so he points out that when the Tsarist Navy gets annihilated by the Japanese, when Russia ultimately is defeated by the Japanese, he says it's an embarrassment for the bourgeoisie globally, right? Because the project that they had invested in, the Port Arthur falls, the Japanese take it. He says it's an embarrassment for them because all the money that they have put into it didn't amount to any successful defense of it. And he'll follow this pattern of looking at the ways in which Western capital is really kind of dictating the actions of Nicholas II, who is, you know, say what you will about, you know, the Tsar's family or anything like that, but policy wise, he's sort of a, what's the word for it? I guess the word in vogue right now is a sub, right? He's subordinate. I mean, he knows that he's a weaker autocratic predecessor. He's trying to be stronger. He's recalling images of old Russia to try to capture this Russian nationalism that he thinks he can weaponize for more legitimacy. But it doesn't work. And his failure in Japan, his failure in October, and the increasing investments of finance capital in Russia are all contributing to a lack of confidence in the Tsar. And Lenin is saying throughout this period, this is what we need to focus on, right? Because this is what's exposing the contradictions of Tsarism. And these are the slogans that are going to convince the workers that this autocracy, this autocratic system is completely bankrupt.
Yeah. And I mean, that this is also like, you know, like Tsar Nicholas, right? Nicholas II, like seems like a lot of people who end up getting overthrown in successful revolutions, which is to say somebody who's like just on a totally like amoral, apolitical, just like neutral point of view, like just seems like whatever else is true about him, he just seems like incredibly incompetent, right? Yeah. Like that, you know, that he's somebody who sort of alternates between authoritarian repression and maybe not being ruthless in certain moments when it actually would have helped him, and, you know, just being generally kind of dumb, especially about like really important issues of like war and peace and things like that, that would actually be pretty important in the long term towards staying in power.
He was mostly aloof to the changes that were happening on the ground socially within Russia. Yeah. The real penetration of capital within Russia. He didn't know how a aristocratic class such as himself could incorporate the emerging bourgeoisie. And this was a question that a lot of monarchies had in Europe, right? The Austrian royal family had the same problem. How do we encourage capital growth while maintaining our aristocratic privilege? Because the two things don't blend. And Nicholas had problems with that. There's this great book by a historian, Richard Wortman. It's called Scenarios of Power. And his argument is that it was the prerogative of each czar to recreate their image upon their coronation, right? It wasn't that they had to recreate their image before coronation, but when you became czar, you had to sort of premise yourself and promote an image of whatever you wanted to be seen as. So for example, Alexander I, right? The czar who helps defeat Napoleon, he projects these sort of angelic and soft images. So if you go back and you look pictures at Alexander I, you'll see the way that he's painted sort of angelically. He's soft. He's seen as sort of a reformer, yada, yada. Well, Nicholas II, the image that he wanted to project was of old Muscovy, right? He wanted to go back to this sort of ancient, not ancient, but medieval Russia to try to recreate this Russian nationalist image, which for the majority of the empire, right? The majority of the empire is ethnically Russian, but it's not by a big majority, right? It's a small majority. I think it's something like 52%, 56% is ethnically Russian in 1914. For a big section of the Russian empire, projecting the image of old Russia, the glory of old Russia, is not really the way that you want to go, especially on the eve of the World War I, which is the sort of culmination of nationalist infighting within the country. So when the war breaks out, there's a whole bunch of people in Ukraine, in the Baltics, who don't really find a purpose in fighting for the Russian Tsar. They see him as, you know, why are we fighting for this guy?
Yeah. So, I mean, from what I've seen, it's like, it seems like that, you know, he was, you know, at the outbreak of World War I, Nicholas, you know, felt like he was under a lot of pressure, but it was really from like, I don't know, certain kinds of like the intelligentsia and whatever to take a stand on behalf of the, you know, Russia's ally, the Serbs, right? Which is how they got into the war, that it would look horribly weak, you know, if he didn't. But like, it seems like that's also, you know, probably, you know, it's really not like the average peasant somewhere in the Ukraine actually gave a shit about that, right? Like, I mean, this is like, it's like, oh wait a second, you want to like take my son off to die because if there's this like thing in the Balkans and it would like be bad for our national honor, if you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Russian autocracy's ambitions for access to the Bosphorus Straits, control access to the Black Sea, and that's why Britain actually offers the Russian Tsar Constantinople if he stays in the war. They offer that to him, and that's sort of Nicholas's incentive for staying in the war, especially while like shit is really hitting the fan, right? His only incentive is, you know, where we've been promised these things if we help the allies in the war. So that I guess brings us to World War One, yeah, which is the sort of culminating moment in Lenin's life in so many ways, and has been historicized well and poorly in both I guess all fields of historiography.
So tell me about this, because there's like a Russian element to this, but there's also a obviously it's a world war, and this is like, and certainly in terms of like what we're kind of getting to the brink of, right, which is like the, you know, Russian Revolution, of course, and the emergence of like capital C communism. Right. You know, this is anything that people think. And, you know, really, to bring us back to your Substack essay, like when they sort of think they're defending, you know, Leninism, right, whatever that means to somebody, like Leninism is really something that's like kind of comes into existence in this like series of events with, you know, World War One and the Russian Revolution and all that. And this is, so again, a big part of that story is playing out within the Russian Empire, but this also has to do with splits and the, you know, what had been a unified global socialist movement before World War One.
Yeah. What I really try to emphasize in the Russia Lenin in 45 volumes project is just kind of the change of his ideas over time. 'Cause Lenin is, to his credit, he is a great historical dialectical materialist, right? He is looking at his own place in time dialectically, looking at the contradictions that are emerging as political situations change and as social relations are sort of morphing. And so the nature of, you know, one good example, I guess, is the April Theses of 1917, where, you know, Lenin comes back to St. Petersburg or Petrograd, and he gives this speech in the April Theses. And the majority of Bolsheviks there, they laugh at him, right? They think that he's nuts. He's making all these demands that that seem so out of reality, out of touch of what's going on with the provisional government. They laugh at him, and it's only later on that they start to adapt to what he's saying. They start to adopt the actual April Theses. One of them being the overthrow of the provisional government and all power to the Soviets, right? He wanted that to be the slogan in April, but most of the Bolsheviks didn't think that the working class was ready for all power to the Bolsheviks to all power to the Soviets to be the slogan. So ultimately he wins, but again, he's responding to very specific historical temporal moments that, you know, another great example of his ability to adapt to changes is the new economic policy, which comes after the revolution and after the Civil War, where he realizes that, you know, maybe this rapid nationalization of industry, this rapid change to a socialist economy isn't such a great idea, right? It's not working. The Russian economy is in shambles after the Civil War. It's in shambles after revolution. It's in shambles after World War One. There's no way to repair it in this sort of new nationalized economy. the only way to rebuild the economy is to permit limited market relations, right? To allow the peasants to bring their goods to a market, for example. It's the only way that you can build an economic industrial base. And so
this is like it seems like a lot of the context that's might be important to sort of fill in for a lot of this, a lot of what you're talking about, both in terms of the Russian Revolution itself, right? Like Lenin with the April Theses, sort of saying that you should, you know, all right, the minimum program, right, has sort of been achieved, right? I mean, you know, the Tsar has abdicated in the face of revolution. There's this provisional government that at least says that it'll eventually call this Democratic Constituent Assembly. But it says, no, we actually need to overthrow that, you know, proletarian revolution in Russia. And this like both that and the context about the new economic policy, I mean, goes back to some of what you were talking about earlier in terms of what kind of country this was, right? Because from a like orthodox Marxist perspective, Russia is in 1917 even is exactly not the kind of place that's equipped to have a transition to socialism. I mean, one of the sort of key tenets of classical historical materialism is that what kind of mode of production you can have, it's possible to have, is downstream of the development of the forces of production, that, you know, you need to have this sort of advanced industrial base to have a chance at, you know, at achieving, you know, like a socialist society. So, but, you know, the calculation that Lenin and his comrades are willing to make in 1917 is like, well, okay, but at that point, they didn't think it was going to be like just Russia going into socialism, right?
Yeah, they sort of make a snap judgment in the July days, what's called the July days, right? Kerensky is the prime minister of Russia, of the provisional government. He recognizes that even though he is now prime minister, order is not being restored to Petrograd. And so he actually invites a General Kornilov, to come back to Petrograd from the front and restore order. And in doing so, the ambitions of Kornilov, who says, like, if I do this, I'm going to impose a military rule with myself at the center. Kerensky kind of realizes at that point, like, oh, shit, maybe it wasn't a good idea to invite him back. And so Kerensky actually sides with the idea of arming the workers against this impending invasion by the military, by Kornilov. Yeah. And so that's the moment in which Lenin and the Bolsheviks are really able to, they do kind of a 180. That's the moment when the Bolsheviks, who refuse the April Theses, they can look at Lenin and say, this is it. Because now we have a working class that is armed to the T. The garrisons were opened up to the workers to defend the city from the military. So again, we're looking at a character, Lenin, who is really great at responding to events as they emerge and recognizing the opportunity as they come up. And that's sort of the philosophical, the theoretical takeaway that I really wanted to apply to Lenin in that article, that he's not just looking at pulling quotes from Marx in the past saying, you know, this is what we need to do. This is what we need to do. No, he's looking at this dialectically, as a good Marxist should, and saying the only way to expose this contradiction or to achieve this maximum program that we want is to know how to respond, and to know how to respond in an organized way.
So I mean, like in 1917, right? I mean, like basically my understanding is, you know, so from, you know, after the World War I breaks out in 1914, and then all of the socialist parties in Europe, or, you know, most of them, right, you know, have sort of, after previously always saying, oh, if there's ever like a big war between the capitalist powers, we'll have like a general strike and stop it. They, you know, do 180, they're caught up in the war fever, and, you know, they support their respective governments, which Lenin sees as this huge betrayal of the international working class. But, you know, he's also very hopeful that World War I's going to end with, like, Europe-wide socialist revolution, which seems not, you know, like, obviously in retrospect, we know that didn't happen. But I mean, at the time, seemed like a very real possibility, right? I mean, that there actually was, like, there were abortive revolutions in different countries, you know, around Europe. And there were points where it seems like this was very close to happening. And so thought, okay, we could establish this beachhead of socialism in Russia, and then it'll spread to the West. So we don't have to just subsist with this, you know, whatever is left of Russia's always already tiny industrial base after, you know, the war and the revolution and the civil war, because we'll have like Western Europe to bail us out. And then like the new economic policy that you mentioned, you know, is kind of Lenin's response to that not happening, right? Yeah. Like that this is saying, okay, well, we're not going to, it's not like Western Europe is going to, you know, rise up in socialist revolution and save us, and, you know, in the, you know, certainly the very near future. I mean, it's optimistic that it would happen eventually. So, just to sort of economically survive, we have to allow this limited reintroduction of market forces, that you can have even, you know, foreign investors in a certain way, even as long as it's, there's ultimately a state monopoly on foreign trade, and they're only just sort of like renting out state-owned assets.
Advertisements. I mean, there are some like really funny, great advertisements from the early 1920s, from the NEP period. They're allowing, you know, the market to exist. You're allowing limited capitalism, and not too dissimilar to China, you know, economic reforms. But although China does it on a bigger scale, but yeah, I mean, and you know, the hardcore Stalinists will hate me for saying so, but you know, Trotsky is another one of those characters that responds, I think, appropriately as conditions are confronting him and the Red Army as he becomes the leader of the Revolutionary Military Council, and Trotsky is the one that's responsible for kind of brokering the peace with Germany. And there's this funny story that that is told about Trotsky's attempts to broker peace at with Germany, where he tells the German delegates that, you know, if you don't sign a peace with us, then we're going to bring all of our literature, all of our Marxist propaganda to the front line, and we're going to distribute it to your German troops. And the German troops are going to mutiny against you. And the German sort of high command at that point just said, yeah, we're going to call your bluff on that one. That's not going to work. And of course it doesn't. And the Brest-Litovsk Treaty is, you know, one of the major points in which Trotsky is called out later as selling out the revolution in a way. But I do think that
it also allows it to survive in like very difficult, you know, circumstances. And this is like, and I really like your emphasis on this, right? And also in the essay that, like, you know, again, whatever you think about, like, we can kind of play the retroactive game of like, you know, who we think had the right, you know, prescriptions and like some distant past historical moment, you know, but certainly these guys were trying to sort of improvise in response to dramatically changing conditions that were conditions that are sort of almost unimaginably distant, right? You know, from the ones that, you know, that we're in now, right? Which really takes us to the kind of core of what you're doing with the essay. But also, since like I know a lot of your, you know, academic work and, you know, some of the stuff I've seen you, you know, talk about with Jason and this revolution has to do with like the late Soviet Union, I also think it might be interesting if you kind of took a moment to talk a little bit about the ways that, like, you know, Leninism, so-called, right, like becomes important for later Soviet leaders and sort of legitimizing their projects, right? You know, that if, like, you know, if you're a Soviet leader and you want to do something really different than, you know, previous Soviet leaders, the sort of best way to find some rhetorical legitimacy for them is say, oh, no, what I'm doing is I'm actually being a better Leninist than the earlier guys.
It's funny because, I mean, everybody I think knows that at this point that Lenin himself probably would have had a negative reaction to the idea of Leninism, right? Because he always argued that I'm a Marxist, right? There's no such thing as Leninism. I am arguing the orthodox Marxist line. But Leninism is created, Marxist Leninism is created after his death, mostly led by Stalin, of course. Mm-hmm. But also the other Bolsheviks are complicit in it. But there's disagreements about what Leninism is, because Leninism is simultaneously the acceptance and the adaptation of the new economic policy while also being the sort of hardline Bolshevik of, you know, the 1910s, right? Mm-hmm. He's two totally different people to a certain extent at that point, because Lenin is reacting to the conditions as they emerge. And that form of Leninism, there's a whole archive that has sort of cataloged quotes from him that people can pull up quotes and, you know, pull out as they want to. His collected works are compiled and published into Russian. I forget the exact number, but they're translated into English and republished in the 60s in 45 volumes, which is the nature of my project. And the idea is, and the reason why this happens in different periods is because each leader of the Soviet Union is trying to use Leninism to legitimate, as you said, their own project. So Stalin's legitimacy is based on the fact that he can argue, I was the closest to Lenin. My ideas, my socialism in one country, my idea of nationalities is the most akin to what Lenin's is, and I'm fulfilling Lenin's goals. Khrushchev will make the same argument, right? Khrushchev will say Stalinism deviated from Leninism. So we have to get back to a sort of an orthodox Leninism. Brezhnev is going to say the same thing right up until we get to Gorbachev, where Gorbachev will, if you read his book, Perestroika, a Revolution for Our Times, he makes the case many times that all I'm doing is bringing the Soviet Union back to its Leninist roots. And he has some legitimacy there, right? He's referring to the new economic policy, Lenin. Right. He's saying, I'm bringing the Soviet Union back to the new economic policy where our founding father recognized that we have to have some limited market.
This is, I mean, that I think for, so I've actually, yeah, I've just been reading Vladislav Zubok's book Collapse, about the fall of the Soviet Union. And, you know, he talks about this a lot, you know, Gorbachev's kind of constant invocation of Leninism to describe both the sort of, I think, like, you know, well-intentioned but badly executed, you know, attempts to reform the Soviet economy, but also also democratizing reforms. And it's like, look, you can find tons of stuff where Lenin at various points talks about the importance of democracy. So it's like, yeah, it's very, you know, like there's plenty that you can draw from there, right? If you want to, you know, if you want to make that case. But, you know, but I mean, like Gorbachev, you know, really, I mean, it's kind of funny if you sort of think about Gorbachev sort of through the prism of how he's like received in, you know, American culture and the sort of bizarre aftermath of like Gorbachev doing like a Pizza Hut commercial and all that stuff, right? But yeah, like, you know, but I think early Gorbachev was probably like very sincere about this, that like, you know, that he thinks that, you know, that like that he really thinks that he's gonna like go back to Lenin and like figure out how to fix the Soviet Union.
I think he was always sincere about it. Until his death, he identified as a socialist. The problem is that the country had just moved in such a way that the reforms opened up too much of a can of worms that was impossible to kind of fit back in. But, you know, it's the point that I wanted to make in the article is that when Gorbachev is recalling Lenin, right, and evoking Lenin, he has as much of a legitimacy in doing that as Stalin did, even though their policies are polar opposites to a certain extent. They both have the equal legitimacy to it because they're borrowing from different periods of Lenin's life. So if you look up quotes by Lenin after 1921, you're going to see a whole bunch of stuff about why limited capitalist relations in Russia is actually a benefit to Russian development. You won't see that in 1905 and 1906 when you're talking about organization and participating in the Duma, but you will definitely see that in 1921. And so, you know, the point that I wanted to make is that invoking Lenin when talking about American politics in 1924, which, you know, if you're active at all on Twitter, then you see it happening. I mean, that screenshot that I have on the article, it didn't take me long. I was writing that part and I was like, I'll go on Twitter and find something. And boom, it was right there. And I was like, you know what? I was going to screen grab that and block out whose name it is because I don't want
to
be.
You're not trying to stir up stuff with a specific person. You're trying to make a general point about the way that people sort of use this for legitimacy. Right. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I always think about this because I'll see people do, and like, you know, whatever, like Marx too, right? I'll see people do this with Marx where they'll sort of, not be like, you know, the way I think you should approach Marx, which is just like, hey, he's a historical thinker who, you know, has a lot of really plausible ideas and, you know, and you should, you know, believe the ones that, you know, you think are supported by good arguments, but like, sort of like, oh, see, Marx said this in this like historical situation where he's talking, he's talking about like the Crimean War or something. And, you know, people are drawing conclusions about it, about how you should feel about like the Russo-Ukrainian War, you know, from like 2022 onward, right? You know, it's like, these are really different historical situations. And like, if there's one thing that like, you know, I mean, certainly as far as Marx, as you say at the beginning of your essay, right, you know, you like to think of Marx as a historian, right? And, you know, and he's certainly, you know, whatever else he is, I mean, certainly one of the main things he is like a theorist about history. And, you know, and certainly one thing that you should get out of reading Marx is that history isn't static, right? Things change, you know, dramatically. And if you're going to sort of relate to events in the real world, right? Like, you know, you have to be attuned to the ways that things change over time. And, you know, so it's like, yeah, you know, Russia during the Crimean War and, you know, Russia in 2022, you're talking about a country that's undergone like multiple changes in like fundamental economic and political systems. And, you know, like,
and yet there are American Marxists I've seen who think somehow that Putin is going to reconstitute the Soviet Union because, you know, in his heart of heart, he's a socialist, but
which is really funny too. Cause, like, look, you know, we were talking earlier about Gorbachev and, you know, and sort of what Gorbachev was trying to do and some of the reasons why it failed, but it's like, you know, Gorbachev at least, you know, like had, you know, his original intention is to sort of reform the Soviet Union and the Soviet system enough to save it, you know, but in some version, you know, whereas like, you know, Putin like comes up as like the designated successor of Yeltsin, who actually, you know, was the sort of leader of the restoration of capitalism in Russia, you know, and in fact, you know, speaking of like uses of Lenin, I mean, one of the interesting things you point to in the article is that, you know, Lenin's popularity in Russia is now, you know, quite high again, but like it's, but you know, something I've seen like Slavoj Žižek point out and some of what he's written about this is that there is this interest in way that like, you know, Putinism is like the Putinist, propaganda is actually pretty hostile to Lenin. Like they have a like Stalin, they kind of like, cause that's like a strong leader, right? Who you can sort of assimilate into the pantheon of, you know, great, you know, strong leaders along with the big czars. But Lenin, it's like, you talk too much about Lenin and that might remind people that it's possible to overthrow the government, you know, like that's pretty dangerous. Right. So, and in fact, in the big speech that Putin gave just before he invaded Ukraine, or, you know, when he was announcing that, he kind of, he blamed Lenin for creating Ukrainian nationalism by, like, you know, allowing them national autonomy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the Putin use of Lenin is certainly very interesting, and it's kind of increasing, right? Since that moment, he's been saying more and more, especially, you know, with the interview with Tucker Carlson, he brings it up again. But the sort of the other point that I wanted to get through in that article, the reason why I call it the cult of personality, right? Because as Marxists, right, we have this disdain, this rejection of what we call big man history, right? And these are histories that are in which there's a figure that sort of seems larger than life, that changed the course of history, and that, you know, is worth emulating and having a bust of in your apartment and you know, icons of above your bookshelf or whatever. And what the argument that I wanted to make is that to ask the question, more or less, are Marxists today more predisposed to this cult of personality? And I wanted to ask, where did it come from? Like, how did it happen that historical materialists, dialectical materialism, for example, now Marxists in the United States are so kind of centered around idealizing these personalities? And you know, kind of in a contradictory way, I do use Marx in the article, and I quote him. I'm going to read the quote. He says, I say that, what if, as Marx said, this adultery is a self-deception, quote, needed in order to conceal from ourselves the bourgeois limitations of the content of our struggles and to maintain our passion on the high plane of great historical tragedy.
Yeah, this is the, yeah. So you're talking about the 18th premiere of Louis Bonaparte, which is like just on a prose level, right? Like is one of the sort of best ever bits of Marx's writing. You know, when he's talking about, you know, he has, you know, he says, you know, Camille Desmoulins, Danton, Robespierre, Saint-Just, Napoleon, the heroes as well as the parties and the masses of the old French Revolution performed the task of their time, that of unchaining and establishing modern bourgeois society in Roman costumes with Roman phrases. You know, skipping ahead a little bit, right? They have, you know, once the new social formation was established, the antediluvian colossi disappeared, and with them the resurrected Romanism, the Brutuses, Gracchi, Publicis, the tribunes, senators, and Caesar himself. Bourgeois society in its sober reality bred its own true interpreters and spokesmen, and the Say's cousins, Royal Collards, Benjamin Constants, and Guizot's. Its real military leaders sat behind the office desk, and the hog-headed Louis XVIII was its political chief. He has this great line in here somewhere about the that where he's talking about the English Civil War in the 1600s, right? He says, similarly, at another stage of development a century earlier, Cromwell and the English people had borrowed from the Old Testament the speech, emotions, and illusions for their bourgeois revolution when the real goal had been established and the bourgeois transformation of English society had been accomplished. Locke's supplanted Habakkuk. So, you know, it's sort of, you know, so Marx is talking about the ways that people who are doing things in the time that they're living in, you know, kind of response to the historical challenges that they're confronted with tend to go back and you know, to like make sense of what they're doing, right? You know, tend to like express it in the language of earlier political developments that, you know, the French Republic has all this Roman imagery, and, you know, and obviously, you know, Caesar is like sort of rhetorically reenacting Augustus and all this stuff, but, you know, it has, this doesn't really tell you what's going on, you know, on an essential level. Right. And obviously the gap between, like, you know, Lenin and the present day is nothing compared to the gap between, like, the Roman Empire and, you know, the French Revolution or the Old Testament and, you know, Cromwell. But there is still something, like, very strange about that, right? This sort of urge to sort of do this kind of historic, like to sort of do political like legitimization of like whatever you think is the correct way to think about radical politics in 2024 in the United States of America through like essentially like role playing, you know, revolutionaries in a crumbling semi-feudal empire, you know, from 100 years ago. And that it's, you know, that's like as different as, you know, as you could possibly get, you know, from the historical situation that you're actually facing. Right. I mean, that this is that, you know, it's really hard to, you know, I mean, we just had, I don't know, like the number one movie in America last weekend was Alex Garland's Civil War. And, you know, you think about all the like sort of criticisms or things people made fun of about the setup of that movie. It's like part of what that's like struggling with is it's like really hard to imagine there actually being a civil war in the United States because, you know, by historical standards, it's, you know, it's one of the most sort of internally institutionally sturdy, you know, states that's ever, you know, existed, right? That they have it's, you know, and the fact that, you know, even though obviously all of us, you know, think that, that, you know, American democracy is not actually all that democratic when you get right down to it. And, you know, and certainly, you know, certainly is like, you know, at the base of the whole thing, there are these capitalist class relations that are bad for all the reasons they've always been bad, right? Like it's still, you know, this sort of advanced democracy that has, you know, like you can talk about the sort of relative fluctuations, but, you know, still has this relatively high standard of living and has this like enormous degree of internal legitimacy of people thinking it's like, yeah, this is these institutions, this is the way things should work. Right. I mean, it's like it's such a different thing, right. From the context of this autocracy that has, educated people everywhere basically see as kind of a weird anachronism that like you have before the revolution, there's decades of like really widespread political terrorism, mm-hmm. you know,
or different from World War One, right? The clash of empires that like, you know, we have these events going on around the world in Ukraine and in
yeah.
but we don't have a world war, right? Let alone a sort of unified socialist party or group, right? There's no international anymore. It doesn't exist. Right. There are different groups around the world. There are communist parties still in different countries, but how much communication is between them? And imagine the United States. Imagine if an international did exist today. Which party in the United States would be responsible for going to the international? Would it be CPUSA or PSL or DSA or, you know, FCOMS or whoever the hell else? I mean, there's so many of them. And yeah, I mean, I'm teaching modern European history this term, and I had them read the 18th Brumaire because, you know, it says a lot about Louis Napoleon. And that's sort of the point that I really took away from it that I wanted to emphasize is, you know, Marx says that the peasants are dumber than a sack of potatoes because they were convinced by history, right? They were convinced by Louis Napoleon that he was somehow an extension of the great Napoleon that emancipated them from feudalism. But he wasn't, right? It was a fool. And so Marx has this famous line that everyone's heard, let the dead bury their dead, right? Let these historical characters, because every time we resuscitate them in our bid for revolution and our bid for recruitment, they don't do us any favors. And it's not that Lenin isn't like revealing in some way. Lenin definitely helps us. The idea of having an organized party that's sort of maybe centralized, right? Democratic centralism, it's a great idea. But do the arguments that Lenin puts forward in 1921 or 1918, do they apply to us necessarily today in a dogmatic sense? No, they can't, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're somebody who thinks that Lenin is interesting and worth studying and, you know, learning from because you're, I mean, doing all this Lenin stuff, right? I mean, like you have you know, doing the series, going through the collected works, all this stuff. But like, there's a, you know, there's a difference between thinking that, you know, that a historical figure, an historical thinker is like, you know, interesting, and you're gonna learn something important, you know, from engaging with him, and thinking that like, this is the, you know, this is the guy who has it all figured out, and now all you need to do is apply it, right? Like, and yeah, you speculate a little bit in the article about some of the reasons why, you know, we might be sort of particularly prone to this now, and you kind of mention, like, I think you basically mentioned two ideas, right? One is, one has to do with something we already talked about, which is that like some of this is sort of imported from, in, you know, like, you know, I don't know, exported to the international left from the Soviet practice of like using Lenin, you know, like kind of turning Lenin into this icon of like whatever people wanted to legitimize at the time at any given stage in Soviet history, which is also really funny because, you know, Lenin himself, right, in State Revolution, has this line about how, you know, it's like living revolutionaries are so much more inconvenient than dead saints, so you can just like use the symbols, right? You know, because like, you know, the living people will talk back to you and say, no, that's not what I mean, right? But then, so part of it might be that Soviet export, but then part of it, you mention our mutual friend, Jason Miles, you know, and like his view that some of this is like just kind of a homegrown American like tendency towards like individualist hero worship.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that it's a blend. I think on the one hand, the cult of personality that developed under Stalin, and, you know, say what you will about Stalin, I think there are pros and some cons about Stalin, but there was undoubtedly a cult of personality that developed. And in the article, I share some pictures of him, like almost as a holy icon, right? That were made at the time. And so there's that. There's the exportation of that. And it happens not just in the West, but, you know, China also adopts this kind of cult of personality from Stalin to Mao. And, you know, it continues forward to these different historical revolutionary figures. That's on one hand, but in the United States, because of our kind of investment in individualism, it sort of takes on a new form, I think, especially today. You could say that, maybe you could say that in the 60s and 70s, there's this kind of, you know, void because Marxism is sort of in crisis at that point in so many ways. But it really is reemerging, this cult of personality, where now if you go on social media, Twitter, or Instagram, there's so many of these kind of cosplaying pages, right, that idolize the past, that are putting out images of Lenin every day with a quote, you know, from him, or Stalin every day, or, you know, people dressing like they live in the Soviet Union still. Which, don't get me wrong, I think some of that is important, right? I think if I'm 18 years old and I see a quote by Lenin that resonates, and it compels me to go and read The State and Revolution, that's awesome. I think that that's great. But what I wanted to be careful of is to say that, look, Lenin, Marx, all of these people that we do venerate in some way, were warning us against this kind of cult of personality, right? They didn't want it, because for them, Marxism is a philosophical, a historical, and a sociological worldview that has to be applied in its time and place. And so that's why Lenin would say, there's no such thing as Leninism, right? I'm a Marxist. I look at the world and situations as they emerge dialectically and materially. That's how I analyze the world. And so I don't like judge, you know, I used to, I will admit that you know, when I was younger, I used to like get into like, you know, fights with people online about, you know, you're misquoting this or you're misunderstanding this. But I don't do that anymore, because for me, the real litmus test of a genuine Marxist is somebody who can interpret and understand the world materially. Right. And that means necessarily that we're going to have some minor disagreements about certain things. But we're all sort of united by the same common underlying sociological and historical view. And I think that that's sort of the, that is sort of a thread that is highlighted in all of my Substack articles, that, like, you know, I'm sick of this politics of competing with people, what I call the cult of the intellectual. Everybody wants to be the priest and nobody wants to be the parishioner anymore, right? Everybody wants to aspire to be, you know, the smartest and the most literate and all that. And I'm sort of sick of it in a way, you know?
Yeah. You say at the end of your Substack, right, this means we should probably leave dogmatism behind, or at least be aware of the limits placed on us by the past. You know, it's a little contradictory to me to make this proposal or refer to Marx. That's the 18th Primera stuff we were talking about earlier. But if dialectical materialism remains the unchanging historical method that we inherit from the past, we still need a new synthesis. Whatever new heroes or predicaments we're willing to hail today will not be farcical copies of the dead, cosplaying historical reenactors, or Chad's aggressively searching for quotes to over-intellectualize present circumstances.
Yeah. So, yeah. Control F was the biggest mistake to humanity. Now we just
God. Yeah. I mean, this is like I was, you know, it used to be right, that like, at least you have a, if you, you know, even if you were like flipping through the book to like try to come up with quotes to like bolster what you're saying, at least you had to flip through the book and you might accidentally learn something, you know, while you're doing it. Right. You know, whereas now it's like now literally you can just search for key terms and, you know, you can find exactly the sentences you're looking for without any danger that you'll, you know, have to read anything around it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the Duma, you know, debate is the most indicative, because, you know, on the one hand, Lenin will say we shouldn't participate in this consultative Duma. On the other hand, he'll say we should participate in this legislative Duma. So when people do that control F through his works, right, they're going to find two separate things. And so
totally right. They could find the context. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And they could find the stuff that, like, from like post, you know, where he's telling like the early British communists that they should vote for the Labour Party, because which, you know, of course, even that isn't like, oh, he's just saying exactly the same thing that like people like me who like Corbyn were saying. It's like, no, he's saying that like he had this very specific strategic perspective because he thought that like a Europe-wide socialist revolution was an imminent possibility, and that we should expose these sort of squishy social democratic leaders by like giving them power to show their limitations and, you know, like whatever. But it's like, whatever you think about that, right, for or against, right, like you can only have a serious discussion about that as like an incredibly specific response to historical conditions at the time. And, you know, even if you conclude that he was totally right about those conditions, that by itself isn't going to tell you much of anything, right? You know, about what to do in, you know, the US or the UK in 2024. You know, you need to actually like form opinions about those societies that are based on an analysis of those societies. And, you know, probably, you know, the issues that you're going to be fighting about then are going to have, you know, very little to do with, splits in the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party in the late Tsarist era. But yeah, I'd really recommend everybody read that essay. So tell us one more time where people can find that Substack.
So the Substack is Alex Herbert, herbert.substack.com. I have some articles that are free, and I'm told that my cost for admittance is cheap, probably too cheap. That's because I feel guilty charging people for my ideas, although I shouldn't, I'm told. So it is relatively cheap. I think it's $30 for a year, which is pretty good. And there's a whole bunch of articles on there. I'm also converting a lot of them to audio. So I'm reading a lot of them out loud and posting them as a podcast called Alex's Substack Podcast. It's real original with the name. I was told it's, you know, I think it was Jason that was like, you should change the name of it so it's more catchy. And I was like, no, because it is a podcast of just me reading the Substack articles. There's nothing else to it.
Yeah, you can still call it something else. Yeah, and then Lennon in 45 volumes. People could find that on Instagram.
People can find that on Instagram, on TikTok, and on YouTube. It's Lennon underscore in underscore 45 underscore volumes. And you know, I just don't have a Twitter for it. I don't understand Twitter all that much still. I have moments. I have like, I'll go days, like 3 days where I'm on Twitter and I'm retweeting stuff, but I'm pretty sure that I'm like shadow banned because my stuff doesn't like circulate.
Yeah, I'm never going to encourage anybody to, as a very frequent Twitter user, I'm never going to encourage anybody to become a frequent Twitter user. You're better off psychologically and, you know, I don't know, spiritually, not doing that to yourself, but yeah, so there is a abundance of Alex content you can find online, I should say. You can also find, Alex on, This Is Revolution, talking to Jason about actually one that I haven't listened to, but I'm so curious based on the title about, Soviet horror movies. I really want to,
I've written two books. The first one was on, punk rock in Russia from the Soviet period to, today to Pussy Riot, essentially. And so I went on Jason's podcast to talk about that. That was a book that I researched for 5 years and it, you know, over 100 interviews to do that. And then I have a movie coming out on May 3rd called Nothing Lasts Forever, Russian Punks in Georgia. And it's about the flight of Russian punk rockers from Russia to Georgia when the mobilization order was called by Putin. And they sort of set up camp in Tbilisi and they have venues now and bands and everything. And then the second book is on horror films in the late Soviet Union. I use the horror films as a lens to look at the different aspects of collapse, from, you know, gender issues that emerge, cultural, generational issues, economic issues, environmental issues, et cetera. So all these films, because horror wasn't allowed in the USSR until the 80s. It was seen as a bourgeois art form, but it explodes after Perestroika.
Well, if I wasn't already anti-Stalinist, that would do it, because I love horror movies. But I'd like to think, like, I know that they're probably really different, but I'd like to imagine just sort of like straight Soviet adaptations of like 1980s, you know, horror movies, you know, what that would be like. But yeah, no, I'm super curious about that. So yeah, people should go check all that stuff out. I hope this is one of many visits that Alex is going to make to the podcast, that we will see him again in the near future. And with that, we've got a couple of announcements. We're going to do a little toast thing, and then we'll go to the post game for patrons. All right, we're back. So yeah, Jake, give us the context for this clip.
This is a video that's been circulating on Twitter. Basically, there's a lot of protests going on a lot of higher education institutions like Yale and Columbia, for instance, and a lot of them have just been going over the line. Today somebody posted a video of a very brave,
what did they say? This is my wife. She's such a brave Jew.
my wife is a brave Jewish woman, I believe. Which is, I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh. This isn't funny.
Not even a little bit. That's
my wife is a brave Jew. We stood alone.
Very, very not funny, but yes, go on.
We stood alone at Yale University today. She wore no mask and was proud. Noticed the horde hiding behind their masks. So should we just check out?
Yeah, let's see this woman stand up to the horde.
Is that original audio? I was going to say, they put that music behind her.
I just felt like it needed some music to reflect the bravery that was on display. I personally wouldn't have done that. Actually, that I can seriously say I personally would not have done
you would, that. You would have had a shirt that said Jew on it and like walked out as if like, I mean, yes, the music is perfect for the clip, but they have a, but like the, but like as like the whole thing is like, actually I saw a, you know, not super lefty account, you know, post like, yeah, I kept waiting for something to happen. Right. When I was watching this, right. It's like the whole thing suggests that like the clip is going to end with like the like slow motion hail of bullets or something. Right. Like that this is the, you know, that like, cause she's being so brave. Right. It takes all this physical courage to walk out there. And, you know, anybody's listening to this later as a podcast, in the clip we watch, right, she has a shirt that says like Jew in the front, as if this is like, this is brave that people are going to see that she's a Jew and attack her, that, you know, because that's what, you know, Palestine protesters do. It's, they're all just like pogroms waiting to happen. And my two favorite things about that clip are, one, that everybody completely ignores her. It's like, not just that they're not like physically attacking her, there's like no reaction of any kind, right? Like nobody gives a shit. And two, as people are just going about their business and ignoring her, one of the things that people are doing is they're folding up behind her. You could clearly see in the clip this giant banner that says Jews for Free Palestine, right? So it's like, doesn't really seem like a crowd to me where, you know, it's like, ooh, better hide the fact that you're Jewish, or, you know, this is like, it really takes bravery to admit that.
Yeah, to HG's point, we did have a discussion. HG says everyone was like, maybe we have to, oh my God, we have to invest more in social workers. I don't know if this person is doing unwell. That's what we were talking about. And if she is not, I honestly, my heart goes out. I do think sometimes it's been, you know, with certain people, like that comedian Brett Gelman comes to mind. Certain people, they really are going on some kind of like real long, almost episode where I wonder, like, like if they're doing okay. You know what I mean? So hopefully she just thinks that was epic and she's doing okay. I do think that, you know, the consensus, like I said earlier, the consensus being broken on Israel is very fracturing some people's minds, and this need to be like, I am the victim here. Do you know what I mean? Jews obviously have been very victimized, but obviously, you know, there's another group of people that are largely the, you know, being victimized right now. And it's
like, not everybody is like, look, they have a, you know, we're talking about this with Alex during the interview. It's like, there's a, like, yeah, Jews have been victimized, but it's like not all times and places are identical to each other, right?
This is,
like, you know, you're not, you know, if somebody is, this is like the, God, I think there's like a clip of, you know, Bell Hooks, where she's like illustrating a point about intersectionality by saying that she feels like the workers she hires to like do repairs on her home are like very disrespectful to her, you know, it's like, you know, doubtless cause she's a black woman. Right. It's like, yeah. Okay. Wow. It's like Sojourner Truth and you, right. You know, basically the same, you know, same set of experiences, right. You know, that the, you know, it's like, yeah, right. It's like, yes, they're, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, anti-Semitism hasn't ceased to exist or anything, like it's certainly not. Right. But like, you know, pretty clearly she's fine, right? Like this is like she's fine. Like they have a like nobody, it's like there's no you know, again, you know, Shai, whatever his last name is, right, the professor from the clip at the beginning, I mean, he's striding up to the Columbia gates in his, you know, Captain Israel cape. Like I don't think he's you know, I don't think he's actually worried that, you know, that he's going to be lynched by a pro Hamas mob, you know, when he gets inside, right? I mean, this is just kind of the, you know, we can speculate about what this says about American culture in 2024, but like, you know, I think that a lot of people who actually support some of the most horrifying acts of state violence going on in the world today are also really, really invested in their own victimhood.
Yeah, But I think Noah actually summed up that in a tweet that I found while you were on air, and I made a graphic of it. That you, Noah Smith, our friend of show.
Friend of show, yes.
Okay, this is unvetted. Andy bringing a tweet to the show. Let's see what it says.
Protester punches baby in head. Well, already off to a strong start. This is definitely a thing that's really happened.
Yes.
Normal person. Hey, you can't just punch babies in the head. Protester. Okay, I think we can all agree that what's happening in Palestine right now is a lot more important than this one baby getting punched in the head. Okay. I'm not, you know, it's possible that the subtleties of Noah's reasoning are just beyond me, but it seems like maybe nothing that people are talking about right now is actually as bad as punching babies in the head.
I think what's important here is that this Noah Smith tweet is retweeted by Noah Smith. Noah Smith said, I don't think that the ideas of Noah Smith are getting out to enough people.
He's also a brilliant scholar.
Yeah, a brilliant scholar. The brilliant words of Noah Smith need to be, if not me, yeah, then who, right? Well,
No, this is, No, I have a, like, my big, you know, we've probably talked about this in the show, but it's been a long time. Like, back in 2020, I did a debate with Noah Smith and, like, Bernie versus Elizabeth Warren. Maybe it was even late 2019. And it was fine. It was, like, very polite. And, like, I got, which also characterized all my subsequent interactions with him until, like, early 2021, when there was that thing about how, like, remember when the Democrats during the election had promised they were going to send everybody a $2,000 check, and then the line of like to the point that like the Warnock commercials in Georgia like had like an image of like a $2,000 check in the commercials, and then they later what they ended up doing is they sent $1,400 checks. And they argued, well, you'd already gotten 600 earlier. So if you think about it, like under Trump, right? So like, if you think about it, like adds up to $2,000. And I was arguing about this with Noah Smith, by the way, is fucking awesome, right? Like really, like try that with your friends in your real life, right? Like that, like tell them you're going to give them $20 and then like give them like 15 and be like, oh, remember that time last year I gave you $5. So if you think about it, I did give you $20, but like, see how they react to it. But, I was arguing with Noah about the $1,400, whether or not $1,400 is the same as $2,000. And like in the middle of this, you know, pretty nerdy argument, he brings up this article that Daniel Bessner, guest next week, by the way, and I co-wrote, you know, a few months earlier or something at that point. And he accused me of being red brown, which is like a weird way of saying like that I'm like, I don't know, dabbling in like fascism or something. And it's like, this is just like, this is the behavior of that I expect from like a really annoying teenage Maoist, not from like this guy who was like a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion at the time that this happened. So, you know, Noah also not sure he's doing okay, but Noah, I promise not to punch any babies at any protests. Once that said, maybe we can agree that like critiquing the chance of 19-year-old protesters might not be as important as genocide, but here's the really important point. In fact, I want to watch the video again to really set this up properly. Well, I think one thing we can all agree is that this is just very, very brave. So, salute this woman's bravery.
You know, there's something about Jewish people and self-sacrifice that she really nailed it on the head there. She took one for the team, just like that I know really also well as a Catholic.
Yeah, that's how we feel inside us Jews at all times. Cheers.
Cheers. All right. Well, Alex, we will see you soon. other three people on the screen can see it about a minute and a half. And the post game, if you're already a patron, you should have a link to that already in your inbox with a very unrealistic start time. And if you are not, there's really no time like the present. Patreon.com/Ben Burgess. If you want to sign up for that, we are going to watch some more of Tucker on Rogan. I don't know where we can go from the spiritual aliens under the ocean floor, but I am looking forward to finding out. So we'll find out in about 2 minutes. Left is best.